The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Africa edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I am joined by Anna Szymanski, the world's most interesting emerging markets expert.
Well, hello.
Except for Yinka Adegoke. Welcome.
Hi.
Yinka, who are you and why are you here?
I'm asking myself the same question. I'm the Africa editor of Quartz, QZ.com. And yeah, we cover Africa business and finance.
Do you say Z or do you say Z?
It depends on what country I'm in.
So Yinka and I used to work together at Reuters a million years ago, and then I wound up wallowing in podcasting, and you are now living on planes, basically flying around the world between various different African countries, and you're based in New York, which is not an obvious.
Yeah, I mean, we looked at it and thought, you know, what's the best way to get this model to work? Because we have the office, obviously, in New York, and we were trying to be as effective as possible in taking advantage of the internet and having an experienced journalist coordinating a team. And the funny thing about Africa coverage is where we are right now in the world and technology is it's actually almost more difficult to run it out of, say, Lagos to cover other African countries. It's probably a bit easier.
We are going to talk about this. We're going to talk about connectivity in Africa. We're going to talk about
quite the segue.
We're going to talk about the whole range of investments that China is making in Africa. We are going to talk about the crazy political scandal in South Africa, which has managed to bring down a relatively large English PR firm and is now threatening to do serious reputational damage to even bigger companies. All of that is to come. But let's start with East versus West, because I feel like a lot of Slate Money listeners know in their mind about North Africa. They have this idea of like this kind of the extension of the Middle East through along the south coast of the Mediterranean. And they know a little bit about South Africa, the country, which is unique in a whole bunch of ways. And then there's that large bit in the middle. And they kind of probably have this idea, well, you've got like Nigeria on the west and Kenya on the east, but what these are economically and sort of culturally and it just in the way that we're looking at that you look at the continent, just like these kind of rival centers and very, very different.
Yeah, they're extremely different. You could say Nairobi's the capital of East Africa for now. It's certainly the leading capital. And Lagos is Africa's biggest city in terms of population and just the sheer numbers of people there. And it's fascinating when you watch how these cities evolve. I mean, I lived in Lagos in the 80s and, you know, a lot of the problems, because Lagos or Nigeria rather had an oil boom, it's accelerated through many of the problems that other cities now have. I now see the same sort of problems when I go to, Abidjan or Nairobi or wherever it is. So,
Lagos is on nobody's list of top tourist destinations.
That's fair. But it is a top destination for people who trying to do business, though.
There are many flights between Lagos and Houston, and I'm sure there's no tourists on those flights. Lagos was always famous in my world for having the most profitable airline routes in the world,
especially our economy for British Airways, big business.
And those seats are not cheap.
Yeah.
Whereas Kenya does actually have a pretty healthy tourism business, and you're going to find a lot more expats there, even though it's a smaller city.
Yeah, it's a smaller city, but they've done a really good job of developing infrastructure there. They've coped with, and this is my point about the acceleration of the, after the oil boom in Nigeria, their growth has been more manageable or better managed. And they've done things like, they've got fast internet there now. They have, a fairly decent road network. They still have a lot of traffic in Nairobi. But it's an easier city to negotiate, to navigate than Lagos. Lagos is always about knowing the right people. I mean, that's kind of everywhere, but more so in Lagos. And the rewards, obviously, like anything in life, the risks are higher, the rewards are also higher, so.
And I believe Nairobi is also known as being the capital of NGOs.
Yes.
And lots of expats, as yes. opposed to Lagos, which is a much more kind of entrepreneurial, global focus. And I think there's a bit of controversy in Nairobi because of that NGO presence and the fact that a lot of companies tend to employ other Westerners, tend not to employ Kenyans, tend to pay the Westerners more.
Yeah, there is a lot of tension with that. That's been going on for a few years now, particularly, as you say, with the NGO sector, but then it kind of spreads into even the startup world, because there's kind of, they're adjacent, there's the social impact kind of startups. So the same sort of culture sort of evolves in that as well, where, people employ the people they're familiar with, and it's funded by, foundations and grant money, and it creates this culture where, Kenyans get left out of it sometimes.
And I think also potentially you can have the problem where you have companies that are better at getting grants than they are running companies.
Yes, definitely.
And, So, I mean, I have this idea in my head that, Nairobi is this kind of expat-filled corner where people are, where the sort of Africa as a country types hang out and pat themselves on the back for being in Africa, whereas Lagos is where the real sort of economic engine of the continent is.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I don't want to just completely dismiss the other 50, right. 60, 70, significant cities. But yes,
including Abuja.
Yeah, well, the thing about Lagos is, even if you're just serving Lagos, that's 20 million people, right? If you're a consumer-facing business, if you could get it right, how you reach those 20 million people is a whole nother story, because the point I make about infrastructure weaknesses and the ability to create any kind of meaningful distribution is extremely tough.
So let's talk about that, because, Kenya is a much, much poorer country than Nigeria. It doesn't have oil.
Do you mean poorer, or do you mean the size of the economy? Because the size of the economy is smaller.
Yeah, but it also it does seem to have come up to speed in terms of certainly information technology much faster than Nigeria.
Yes.
And everyone pays for everything using their phones. There's pretty good fast internet across the country. Was that a kind of top-down decision by some enlightened government, or how did that happen?
Some of this stuff happened accidentally, but the governments will. I think going back to I think it was President Kibaki. They did sort of have a plan to improve road networks, and they actually implemented them. The thing is, lots of countries have plans, so it's not like it's just that they actually carried out some of them. And so
the difference is that if you have a plan in Nigeria, it just winds up getting mired in corruption and going nowhere. But every so often, plans in Kenya will actually come to fruition.
I think that's almost fair. Yeah, I think that's almost fair. But listen, people make a lot of money in Nigeria.
I'm sure.
Right.
I don't just mean...
And not just the oil.
Yeah, not just the oil. I mean, the telecom sector. Yeah, and
people make a lot of money. Because there's international companies.
Yeah, and there's a real question if you're looking at international investors. You're not looking at Kenya. You're looking at the place where there's real entrepreneurial activity. I'm not saying there's not entrepreneurial activity in Kenya, but if you're solely focused on social impact investing, And that's the only people who can really get funding that is going to limit your potential.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
And then does the same kind of distinction hold true beyond just those two countries? Can you kind of lump Ghana in with Nigeria, lump Ethiopia in with Kenya?
No, I mean, Ethiopia has a completely different dynamic. Ethiopia is, I think, definitely the fastest growing economy in Africa this year, and has, you know, grown in leaps and bounds in the last few years. But they definitely are following more of the Chinese model, you know, much more top down. Again, you see all these numbers, the macro numbers, that they're great for Ethiopia, but there's still a lot of poverty. There's still,
and all the divisions
and there's the divisions with the sort of people unhappy with the way the country is not just being run, but how, you know, there's a lot of calls for federalism and all that stuff going on as well politically. But in terms of the economy, in terms of I don't see in my travels, in my work, and I get a lot of information sent to me every day, I don't get a lot of emails about Ethiopian startups, as an example, right. You know, just a way to think about.
Whereas you do get a lot of emails about Kenyan startups
all the time,
and Nigerian startups.
Well, I think Rwanda. Bit. Actually, Rwanda is a little bit closer to that kind of the Ethiopian issue as well, where the country is really well run from the top. But I've visited a few times, and I don't see a lot of local entrepreneurial vigor. They talk about it a lot, but you know, I don't see it very often when I'm there.
And that's actually raises a question I'd like to ask in terms of the reality versus the hype of the kind of innovation economy throughout Africa.
Right, because we do hear this a lot.
Yeah, as do I.
I mean, I feel like I, you know, that's one of the reasons you have a job, right? They're like, oh my God, Africa's this amazing innovation economy. We should cover this globally from Quartz. Is that how real is that?
I think Africa should be covered anyway.
Well, exactly.
So that's my starting point. But certainly when we at Quartz thought about this, it really was, let's try and cover the newer ideas. And when we talked about innovation, we didn't just think about it as tech and startups. We really would think about new ideas because, you know, we know all about the problems, and there are lots of smart people who've either studied in the United States or Europe or wherever you, or at home, who are trying to fix these things. And there are lots of new ideas, and some of those ideas will go both ways, you know. So there's a lot to talk about there in terms of innovation. There is innovation happening. There are some things that are, you know, as you say, Anna, that are overhyped, and, you know, people make a bigger deal about it than it is. But for the most part, what you have, if you really think about it, is, when you don't have the long legacy of, you know, big institutions and big companies, and, you know, it's a blank sheet of paper. So people are experimenting all the time, and that's really interesting and exciting.
So you've been covering this for a while. What's the most like overhyped idea, and what's the idea which has actually gained the most traction since you've been like on this beat?
Oh, that's a tough one. Overhyped ideas. Let me. I think the one that sometimes, you know, the one that is obvious, and it's not so much that it's gained the most traction, but sometimes, you know, almost gets overlooked, even though people talk about it a lot, is M-Pesa, the mobile money. Because even though I think the thing that impresses me most with it, M-Pesa is, for those who don't know, is the mobile money system in Kenya, which is spread to Tanzania, Uganda, and a couple of other countries in East Africa. And, you know, it's accounted for 40% of Kenya's GDP in, well, not accounted for, but 40% of Kenya's GDP ran through
And M-Pesa, weirdly, is one of those top-down things, right? It was more or less invented by Safaricom, and everyone was like, yeah, we trust Safaricom, we'll give them our money, and then we'll use it. We'll use that money that we have on our phones for cell service, and we'll use it for a million other things as well. And it becomes like the sort of de facto currency, the way you pay for things.
Yeah, exactly.
And the big question with M-Pesa for many years was always like, can it expand beyond Kenya effectively? And does it need to have that monopoly status where, you know, it's the only game in town? The only other country where I see, you know, that level of mobile payments is China, which is also a very kind of top-down place.
Yeah. I think the story with M-Pesa is kind of an interesting one in that it was almost one of those ones where one of the problems that happens a lot in Africa, especially with technology, is you have an issue with regulators. And this was one of those ones where the central bank just kind of got out of the way and went, let's not worry about this. It's a small thing. And it just blew up.
Yeah.
It became this big thing. It kind of caught them off guard. I mean, because if they had, you know, done the usual thing, it would have got mired in KYC.
That's actually interesting. That's part of the reason we actually haven't seen the real development in fintech in the United States is because of the regulations around the banking system and why you have seen more of it throughout Africa, China, you said, and even in London. And I'm also interested in the ability of, because when we talk about M-Pesa, again, you're talking about something that's a bit more top down.
Yeah.
If we're looking at smaller, really innovative companies, what happens with the issue of access to financing? Because you think of Silicon Valley companies that can kind of go for a while, not really making any money. They keep accessing financing. Is that really possible in Africa?
That's like you've just hit on one of the biggest debates in the whole sort of startup ecosystem, particularly in places like Lagos, where they're real kind of entrepreneurs trying to do things. And there's this small amounts of money and you give up all your company and you get a certain amount of money, get to a point, and then where do you get the next amount of money? Because here's the biggest problem. There are very few opportunities for exit. The market's not liquid enough through IPO, so that's not even on the table at all. So everyone's hope is that they get bought, and there's a limit to how many companies are going to buy you, or the limit to how many companies are even interested in thinking in this sort of forward-thinking way. So it's an exciting space and people are trying new things. And, you know, we had a panel the other day at the office where we had a few African entrepreneurs in, and they talked about, VCs in, and they talked about, well, you know, for us, we don't fund companies unless they actually have revenue and we feel they're close to going to make profit at some point very soon, you know, as against to what Anna referred to there, where, you know, how long did Facebook and the rest of them go on for years?
Uber's still going.
Well, right. After a fashion.
Yeah.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Let's segue a little bit to the 60-pound gorilla in this entire continent, really, which is China. Because for all that VCs are coming in with their million-dollar checks, China's coming in with like hundreds of billions of dollars. Mm. And I used to write about Latin America for a living, and I saw how Ecuador became basically a sort of wholly owned subsidiary of China. I'm looking at Venezuela right now and the way that they are owing like enormous amounts of China, and China has a huge control over what happens there. For all that there's a bunch of like bottom-up innovation going on across the continent, is this ultimately going to be a China story as it plays out over the next 10 or 20 years?
Yeah, I think the influence of China is almost understated. I mean, there was a bit of hype a couple of years ago, and it seemed like, oh yeah, and everyone saw it through the prism of neocolonialism, and it was just that. That was the sort of way the story was framed. It's far more nuanced and far more interesting than that. And even I was guilty of thinking it was something that would pass in a couple of years. But it's the relationship between China and Africa is going deeper. it's coming from, the reality is it's coming from three different ways. It's coming from the top, as we know. That's what we see, the macro discussions, how much is China, the country, the government, lending to these other governments, how many of their buildings, you know, official buildings are being built, being given away as gifts to governments. You have sort of mid-sized companies, Chinese mid-sized companies and local entrepreneurs coming together, coming in and just straight up just doing business, and doesn't necessarily involve government, just going there entrepreneurially. And then they're Chinese laborers, Chinese workers, who sometimes come with the big companies and just end up staying. And just people who just want to just leave China and try their luck because they've heard, you know, there's this gold rush in Africa, and they come and try their luck, and they're on the streets of, name the city, you know, they like, I read a story about Lesotho, where's, you know, Lesotho, and they had protests there because these local Chinese women were putting the local women out of business by selling textiles, you know, so this is that at that low level,
not just
at the top, not just in the mid-sized companies, it's throughout the system.
And as you're saying, I think it's a complicated story because on the one hand, you have had a lot of Chinese investment into infrastructure, which has very much been needed. And also, again, we were talking about access to cheaper financing.
Right.
But then in exchange for that, they're also getting preferential trade deals. They're also getting access to all of these infrastructure contracts. And they're also then, the many African countries are now importing the cheap Chinese goods that are then affecting the manufacturing incomes of many of these countries.
There's a really interesting theory I was reading about this, just the other day, that China or Chinese goods are flooding markets and distorting a ton of businesses, local businesses. But they're also thinking about, some of these companies are also thinking about offshoring manufacturing to some African countries. So there's this weird thing going on where it's not so clear whether this will be a wash or whether, you know, it's...
But there's clearly a huge... There are lots of ties. There's lots of trade in both directions. There's trade not just in goods, but increasingly in services and increasingly in individuals. There are, like, as you say, there's a rapidly growing Chinese population in China. Where would you say, which African cities have the biggest Chinese population?
I'm not sure which have the biggest, but they're pretty much in every country because it's not, they really are in the smallest of countries to the biggest of countries. I thought Lagos, Nigeria was like impenetrable to them, but they're everywhere. Huawei, everybody, you know, so it's the big guys and the little guys.
I saw one stat where Chinese infrastructure investment went up from like $1 billion a year in 2000 to like $55 billion in 2015, is not slowing down anytime soon.
But one thing that though has been slowing down slightly is the Chinese economy, which again shows you this connection because many African economies also are extractive economies, and so they're very dependent on commodity prices. And as China shifts to a less resource intensive economy, that's really slowing down economies throughout Africa. Both because of just lower Chinese consumption and commodity prices being lower.
Yeah, that's been the story since
2014.
Since commodity prices dropped off because Chinese demand dropped. But tell me
about Anna's favorite subject, which is One Belt, One Road. My friend Simon, I promised I would give him all credit for this. He's like, Africa is basically just like three belt loops. It's Kenya and Djibouti and Ethiopia, these little on the maritime road up through the Suez Canal. And it's One Belt, One Road is this just unimaginably enormous project to tie China into the world basically through both land and sea. Africa's on the sea bit basically. Is this going to sort of transform the coast of East Africa?
Possibly. I mean, I think I almost feel like that's going to happen anyway, but this is going to accelerate it if they really, you know, through resources, as I imagine they're going to.
And this is interesting, though, because I mean, if you're talking about One Belt, One Road, yes, this is definitely an economic story of trying to export their excess capacity, steel and such. But it's also very much a political story in terms of China trying to export its influence and have gaining more political friends and control. So then when they go to the UN, they then have a lot of other countries that are now going to vote with them because they've been investing there. And also because China's also promoting a different model that's opposed to or very different from the kind of liberal democratic model that also a lot of other countries are saying, oh, well, you know, this is another option.
Is the form of Chinese government, the kind of, you know, single party system overseeing a sort of very capitalist economy, that, you know, that seems to align itself more comfortably with somewhere like Rwanda than the sort of liberal democracies that we're used to here in the US.
Yeah, and Tanzania, which is often not talked about in this context, but their president who came in 2015, John Magufuli, is definitely going down that road. You know, Ethiopia.
Is the influence of China on Africa bad for what you might call the spread of liberal democracy? Is there any hope for liberal democracy in Africa? We're going to talk about this more in the South African context. But like, as far as the rest of the continent is concerned, I feel like I've had 20 years of hope that, you know, things are going to change and corruption is going to go away, and it never seems to happen.
Right. I think the thinking now, I mean, it's fascinating, because I think what China and anybody else's their influence and on the thinking is, hang on, you know, sure, we want to do this democracy thing, but we want to make our countries better as well. And, you know, if it means, because everyone's looking at Rwanda and they get there and they see the clean streets and the everything's kind of working well, and it looks.
And if the cost of that is locking up a bunch of opposition politicians,
freedom of the press.
So, but it's a serious point, right? Because there's serious poverty, there's serious problems. So, if you can actually, because that's the one thing. Everyone, we talk about corruption like as much as anybody else, but I often say, to talk specifically about Nigeria, I always often say, well, is it just corruption? It just seems there's just a huge amount of incompetence. People just don't seem to know what they're doing. You know, even the corruption is like schoolboy. It's like, you know, if you can actually get something that works, and you could do it without
Rwanda corruption that works,
and do it without, I don't know, all the other negatives that come with it. I'm sure a lot of even Western countries will go, okay, you just get on with it.
Well, that's what they did in Indonesia, right, under Suharto, where you had enormous economic growth and everything was enormously corrupt. And it kind of, you know, in terms of GDP.
Yeah, it works to a point. I mean, I think that's the problem, is that corruption, we'll get into this when we start to talk about South Africa, but has a real cost. And it tends to trap countries in that kind of low to maybe mid-income trap. And you really can't get beyond that because you don't get a lot of international investment.
And you don't have civil society.
Exactly. It's inefficient allocation of capital. There are a lot of lots of reasons.
Yeah. But like I say, this is just people now rethinking about this. I don't know.
The question is, in terms of China, would it be fair to say that the influence of China on Africa is going to make Africa richer, but also less democratic?
Oh, so tough to say. It's very possible. I think it's possible, but it's always going to be on a country by country basis. It's such a difficult thing to just make that broad.
What's the shining beacon hope of democracy in Africa right now?
Or to put it this way, you know, just because China is favorable isn't going to make Nigeria, as an example, the largest country on the continent, suddenly go, okay, yeah, I'm not going to have, you know, proper democratic elections next time, because there'll be war, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's not, it's not quite that easy. Now, with the smaller countries where one person's been running for a while and maybe they're competent, maybe that could work. But I just think some of the other countries where there's so many different ethnic groups, different people with different vested interests, I think democracy is their one way other than military rule that can keep things sort of...
On a scale of 1 to 10, how democratic would you say that Nigeria is?
I'd say about 6. Yeah, but I wouldn't go the full 10. I wouldn't go much higher than that. And again, it's just almost as a way to prevent chaos. Mm-hmm. In a way, right? So it's not, even though there are lots of people who probably would rather they could do things without following proper democratic rule, they will because the price is too high.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
So let me ask you the same question about South Africa. We'll segue over there on a scale of 1 to 10. How democratic is South Africa?
Actually, I think South Africa is surprisingly democratic. I mean, I look at some of the, if we're talking about the crisis that's going on there right now, a lot of it is because they actually have proper rules and regulations and they actually follow them to some extent. The fact that an individual president doesn't follow them is another thing.
I completely agree. I think this is actually very similar to what we're seeing in Brazil. People point to the corruption. They say, oh, this means the country's not democratic. You're like, no. If this was undemocratic, you would not be seeing these protests.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. No, it's amazing. I mean, the anti-corruption person, I've forgotten her job title, Mandosela, she stood up to Zuma and exposed all the corruption that was going on, did a long report on state capture. And, you know, you don't see that in a country that's not democratic or at least...
I agree. I think South Africa is democratic. I think that's one of the reasons why they are calling in expensive British PR companies to do election campaigns because they want to move public opinion and they want to get people to vote for them. But yeah, how did that work out?
Not too well.
So give us the TLDR on what happened there.
Long story short, there has been a family called the Guptas, Indian immigrant family, as against long-term South African, that moved there in the 90s, got close to Zuma in his early days in the ANC. And when he became president, their company, Oak Bay Capital, was given a whole bunch of favors, end up at some point, a wedding of one of their kids was like on taxpayer, paid by taxpayer.
And was written off as a business expense.
Was written off as a business expense by KPMG. Yep. What had happened was that they ended up just completely in control of the government, or at least in control of Zuma in some way. They were effectively appointing ministers, and when all this stuff came out, they'd invite a potential would-be minister to their offices and say, well, you know, do you want to be Minister of Finance? Or, you know,
and we're literally offering like suitcases of cash.
Yeah. It was kind of crazy. And what that is, and that was all bad enough. And that was all terrible. And that was straight up corruption. But then to your point about PR companies, Bell Pottinger, they, as the situation got more difficult, they called in a PR firm, Bell Pottinger from London, to help distract people. And the way they went about this was to put out this whole concept of
white monopoly capitalism.
White monopoly capitalism, which, you know, in a country where, you know, the black unemployment rate is, for young South Africans, is around 40%, where on the, I can't remember what the huge amount of the wealth of the country is concentrated in, with about 8% of the population, white population. This is a very sensitive thing. People are extremely sensitive about this.
And so just to be clear, what exactly happened? The Zuma government started brandishing the opposition as instruments of white monopoly capital,
right.
So, and basically turning politics into this.
Right.
Kind of
Gupta, the Gupta family is essentially trying to argue that what the people who criticized them for state capture were really just these white monopoly capitalists.
Exactly. Exactly.
So basically, Zuma is to whites what Trump is to Mexicans.
Yes. I actually, you know, this is what's one of the things that's been interesting about watching Trump is like so many of the tropes are like very African, like these populist things, because whether a president is very democratic or just, you know, in charge, they all play the populist game. They all play to the lowest common denominator all the time. So, yeah, which is what our guy here does. But yeah, you see this has been led to Bell Pottinger being exposed and everyone turned on them.
They got kicked out of whatever sort PR union shop.
Yes.
And then all of their clients left them, and they no longer exist. And now the scandal is expanding a bit. It's now what, KPMG, McKinsey, mm-hmm. How are they involved?
Yes, I mean, KPMG both signed off allowing them to, as we said, write off like weddings as business expenses. Also signed off on reports that were used to actually oust anti-Gupta ministers, which is actually almost the more significant issue.
That's the more significant.
Yeah, the McKinsey issue is a little complicated. It has to do with this Gupta-connected company, Trillion, who apparently was using their access to state-owned companies to get contracts. And then it appears that McKinsey was maybe using them as a subcontractor and getting paid for work that was never actually done. So it's a big deal. I mean, this is the kind of thing that not only could significantly hurt the reputation of McKinsey and KPMG, but also really affect international investment and activity in South Africa, which I think is another issue that isn't talked about enough.
But the thing I find the fascinating thing is it will affect everyone except Zuma. He'll still be president. That's the fascinating thing about South Africa.
So unlike Brazil, he's safe.
He's safe.
Right, because even when the ANC had
anyway, he's going out 2019 anyway. And the only thing he needs to take care of is to see if his ex-wife can be next president, so that they don't come after.
Oh, she's supposed to be a better figure than him, right? Like,
yeah, but the price she has to pay, or the deal she has to make, the devil's deal, whatever you call it, is that you're not going to come after me, are you? Okay, then as the mother of my children or whatever, that's supposed to be.
But no, I mean, and I think that part of the reason I'm wondering, I mean, to me, it seems like there's been so much popular opposition now to these recent scandals with these hashtag campaigns of like KPMG must fall and McKinsey must fall, you know, and really popular opposition. And I'm wondering if it's just about, you know, the Gupta family, or whether it's just a larger anger about what's going on and what's happened with the ANC and like what we saw in the last elections where the ANC did as poorly as they've ever done.
Yeah.
And because, again, this is what we go back to talking about before. Corruption has a cost. And, you know, South Africa would probably be struggling regardless because, again, with commodity prices being down, that's going to hurt them. But their economy is also really hurting by the fact that now it's, you know, their debt was downgraded to junk. It's more expensive for them to borrow. That means it's more expensive for private companies to borrow. That means that you don't have as many, you know, private enterprises coming in. And this affects the average person.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of frustration in South Africa. It's a country I find fascinating whenever I visit. Everything in South Africa, for me as an outsider, is like through a prism of race. It's this, you know, people are really sensitive about it, and which is why this white monopoly capture thing was so capitalist thing was so insensitive. But you know, you have a whole generation of what they call the born frees or free borns. I can't remember what the expression is. People born after 1994 who were just growing up and thinking, I don't understand why I'm living in a shack. Why are we still living in shacks? What's going on? Particularly people in the cities, in the townships. There's a lot of, and you can see that with the xenophobic attacks on other Africans, because other Africans come to South Africa and they go, oh my God, your electricity works and the roads are, everything's great. You know, I'm just set up a business then. And, it's just frustrating to the majority of South Africans.
So basically, the Brits can come in, the Nigerians can come in, the Kenyans can come in, the Chinese can come in, the Indians can come in, yes. And they all come in and make lots of money. And the people who were suffering under apartheid and had no money at all are still getting nowhere.
Exactly right. And that, and it's not, I mean, as with any of these things, it's never that simple, but that's pretty much the sum of it, though. And
the ANC, for all its, its founding mythos has failed to really solve this problem.
Yeah, nothing has really changed that significantly for the majority of people. Yeah, listen, there is a black middle class, but it's relatively tiny and... Anna referred to all the hashtags, the fees must fall with right. The universities was about that. It was like, how do we even get into these universities? Because South Africa has three or four of the few universities on the continent that has proper, almost world-class universities in the sense that they have proper R&D and research and file papers and all that kind of, all kind of normal stuff. But they're not cheap for children of poor people, So there's just a lot of resentment, it feels like, whenever I, visit or cover the stories, read about it,
So in terms of inequality, which is seemingly, the inequality problems in South Africa are clearly exacerbated by the racial history of the country. But the racial inequality aside, is the economic inequality worse in South Africa than it is in most of the rest of the continent?
I think that's a great question. I've never looked at the numbers. But I think, we're all humans. We know how this works.
Yeah.
If you can see, when it's so visible.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what people react to more so. But you're right. I will make a reference to the country I know well, Nigeria. There is a lot of inequality in Nigeria, a lot. But I guess everyone thinks they have a chance. That's the thing about, Nigeria is a bit like America in that sense. Everyone thinks, it could be me. I mean, literally. Mm-hmm. They actually had a lottery campaign with that tagline. It could be you. So I think with South Africa specifically, I think, it probably doesn't look like it could be you.
Yeah, and this goes back to the problem of corruption again, talking about. Because the problem is when you have these very corrupt governments, you don't have competition. You have so much bureaucracy. The only way you can start a business is by aligning yourself with the government.
Yes.
You don't create businesses and, the economy really suffers.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
On which uplifting note, I think we should just move off the continent and start doing a numbers round, because I feel, I know, come on. Okay, I'm just going to come back to Yinka and say, listen, we can't end there. We need to end on a high note. Give me a data point. You can have a number separately, but just give me a story. Give me a short little something to get excited about, something why, you know, a reason to believe in all of the innovation, Africa is the country of the future, you know, hype that we've been hearing for so long. It is a country, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They always have that joke about Brazil. It's the country of the future and always will be.
I haven't got a number, but I do feel that smartphone penetration, as simple as that might sound, is only just taken off. And that's really, you know, that's really going to have an impact on everything from remittances, ease of remittances, to payments, to access to information. Because that's kind of one of those things that you might underestimate, which is people are just not aware of a lot of things around them.
And the minute they get their first iPhone.
Yeah.
Well, it's not an iPhone.
A Chinese-made iPhone.
Some kind of Chinese-made Android device. That changes.
Yeah. I'm just speaking on a really basic level because I don't want to... I have no insight into an individual startup or what have you. I just feel that as more people... When I look at those numbers, and I wish I'd written one down now, but... The speed with which people are beginning to take up smartphone devices as the devices get cheaper, which is why I made the joke about the Chinese made. Because
you can get a very good Android phone for, $20 now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Africa is very young, right? It's the one thing that all all these countries have in common is they're all very young. So... young people tend to figure out ways of using things and doing positive things. We tend to see the negative ones, right?
And then the other thing which we have to mention as well, which everyone always underestimates, is the development indicators. Things like, you know, how many years of education do girls get? What's the life expectancy at birth? Anything you want to look in, sort of health and education, access to clean water, literacy.
All of that is positive.
Looking really, mm-hmm. really, really positive. Something like, 90% of the continent is now vaccinated against all major diseases, which is probably better than the USA at this point.
Especially better than some counties in California.
Exactly. So, you have this young...
Yeah.
population, which is going to...
And it ties into my number, actually, but yeah.
So what is your number?
My number is 68 million. And 68 million is the projected population of Niger Republic, which is north of Nigeria. And it was a number that I had an interview with the former Nigerian president, Obasanjo, some weeks ago during the UN General Assembly, and he talked a lot about demographics and the demographic dividend challenge of Africa, and he highlighted Niger Republic because he highlighted it because in 1960 the population of Niger was 3.4 million. You know, as it's going to grow 20 times. So it's just kind of astounding how quickly, and it actually ties in with a lot of the stuff you mentioned there. All these improving indicators are actually also have this kind of weird, I don't want to call it a downside, where the populations are getting out of control and they don't actually have the resources to feed all these people, much less, you know, get jobs, you know. So it's just a number that's been on my mind, because I feel it's another challenge for many countries. If you don't manage populations or figure out ways to serve fast growing populations, you're going to have a lot of more problems down the road.
That's never.
Yeah, a bunch of unemployed young men, especially. Yeah, it's never good. Yeah.
I mean, these guys are they're right next door to the, you know, the Maghreb region.
Yeah, I mean,
You see, you're just going to bring us down, aren't you? No matter how hard I try, it's going to be like, oh,
my number is really sad, too.
All right, what's your sad number?
I actually have two numbers, but they go together.
Okay.
And I also kind of stole this from Marketplace. So my first number is 55,431. And my second is 25,000. So one of those numbers is the number of Starbucks in the entire world. The other one is the number of places you can buy a gun in the United States. So,
ooh, I wonder which is the biggest.
Yes. So again, there are far more places to buy a gun in the United States than there are actually Starbucks in the entire world.
Can you buy a gun in New York City?
It's very hard.
Yeah.
There are gun shops, but unless you're like a cop, good luck with that. My number is 5 million, which is a dollar amount. It's $5 million. You might recall the Fearless Girl statue down by the Charging Bull in Wall Street. The Fearless Girl statue was an ad campaign basically by State Street, which is this big fund management company, trying to talk about women's equality and how women
with a little girl.
With a little girl. And $5 million is how much money State Street has agreed to pay because it underpaid 300 women in just 2010 and 2011, much less than the amount of money that they were paying the equivalent men.
That's brilliant.
That's amazing. We are just full of uplifting stats, aren't we?
Thank you, State Street, for our daily dose of financial irony. With that, I think we're just going to bring this episode to a close. Next week, we will try and be more uplifting. But thank you to Yinka Adegoke for coming on to Slate Money. And it's good to have a little international flavor on here once in a while.
This has been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Thanks to Dan Schrader. And remember, guys, that we have a live show on November 15th at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Go to slate.com/live, and we will be talking about everything food. That's 7:30 p.m. in Brooklyn. Buy tickets for that. They will sell out pretty quickly. Also, listen to Amicus, which is apparently how Americans pronounce amicus.
It's an amicus brief?
It's an amicus brief. I don't know. Maybe it's an amicus brief and I've just been pronouncing it wrong all this time. Listen to Amicus, however you pronounce it, at slate.com/amicus. That's Dahlia Lithwick's show, which comes out every other Saturday, about the law, the Supreme Court, and basically everything you need to know about American jurisprudence. With that, it falls to me only to thank Dan Schrader and to thank you all for keeping the emails coming. It's slatemoney@slate.com, and we will talk to you next week on Slate Money. Tell me what's in and talk. Nobody matter.